The 90 and 9 from Andrew Peterson. David, I didn't know you could clog that way.
Oh,
you're really rocking the newsroom there. Isn't yeah, it? Yeah. Wow, you
and
were good.
Sitting down. That's the best part.
It's the only way people our age could do clogging, I think. We're joined now by Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times. It's 11 minutes after the hour on a Wednesday. And Doug, we're glad you're here. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Well, you're quite welcome. Always pleased to be back.
Still riding high from last week. That was just exciting last week about Jesus and the synagogue in Nazareth. And especially, I appreciated the whole history of why it was, you know, you need the history of how the Jews came back to the area and settled in the north rather than the south, and the political ramifications of that. And, of course, the Assyrians who had introduced people of different cultures into the area, so it was kind of a Gentile area, but the Hebrews came back from Babylon. Now that Jews could govern other Jews again, they felt a little more secure, a little more excited about coming back. And this is maybe a little bit of a digression, but it's my impression that when the Jews were taken into captivity to Babylon, that over time they came to dominate the culture of that city, because it did become quite a center of Jewish thought and writing, didn't it?
Well, you've made two observations there. It certainly did become a center of Jewish thought and let's call it intellectualism, if you will, maintenance and growth in the oral tradition. Whether it came to dominate the Babylonian culture, I'm not so sure. But certainly within their own community, they were strong and vibrant.
And excited about coming back. I mean, the goal had always been to come back and reestablish the temple in Jerusalem, but they chose to live in the north. Why was that again?
Well, because that's where the Gentiles are all living. If you've spent any time in Israel at all and contrasted the topography and the climatic conditions and the geology conditions and the temperatures of the south versus the north, the south is a very Spartan, ascetic place to live. I mean, it's difficult down there. And the soil and the rainfall patterns are much more accommodating in the north. And so if you were a Gentile and you had a choice where you wanted to live in this land, you would automatically choose living on either the coastal plain or in the north and avoid the south from an economic harshness of life reasons.
But those Jews that returned from Babylon, wasn't the goal to be in Jerusalem?
Actually, I think we would think so, and perhaps for some it was, but their bigger goal was to redeem Israel for Messiah when Messiah came. And so their view, their priority really is to get the Gentiles out of this land. And so they began to establish what we would call today as settlement communities. They really did have a settlement mentality and orientation. We think that's what Nazareth was, one of many settlement towns.
You mean kind of like enclaves? The word enclaves carries with it a connotation of being in hostile territory.
But, yes.
Yeah, in a small
particular, for sure.
Yeah.
And then gradually expand out over time as your town grew, and ultimately to take control and domination over that part of the country and drive the Gentiles out, or as that Isaiah 61 verses 4, 5, 6, and 7 tell us, they had the view that they would be over the Gentiles, that this whole thing would be reversed, that the Gentiles would be their servants and their workers, and they would live off the riches of the nations. And that's all part of the rationale that has brought them back to the northern part of Israel, because of what's in Isaiah 61 verses 4 through 7.
So Isaiah was still highly valued as a prophet in the time from the captivity to the time of the return, and so Isaiah was really elevated in their eyes. I'm assuming that.
Well, and you know, when we talked in the past about Jewish education, all of the men would have been incredibly familiar with Isaiah, probably memorized it, and they also remember the prophecy from Isaiah 9 that in the land of Zebulun and Naphtali, a great light would shine. And they have come to understand that, is that's where Messiah will appear first. So that's yet a second reason why they are in the north and not in the south, because it's in the north that Isaiah prophesied Messiah will be seen first. And these are messianic zealots, and they want to be there where it's going to start.
Now, Nazareth is on the southern edge of the Jezreel Valley, which we know as the area of Armageddon. Megiddo is a city there, correct?
Megiddo is on the southern edge of the Jezreel Valley, mm-hmm. pretty much in the central portion there. It sits astride what's known as Megiddo Pass. There are three major passes that go through this ridgeline. Mount Carmel Ridge takes us closer to the sea, and it's where the International Highway crosses the Jezreel Valley. Megiddo Pass is part of the International Highway. Megiddo is probably the most strategic piece of real estate in this most strategic of lands, and that's why it's been fought over 21 times and rebuilt 22 times over the course of history. He who controls Megiddo controls trade, pretty much north-south trade through the International Highway, and the east-west trade that's going from the Jordan Valley Rift towards the Mediterranean seacoast here to the port towns of Tyre and Sidon. So, yeah, it's Megiddo is the place in this country that you want to control. You control Megiddo, you control trade, you control this country.
And how far and in what direction would you find Nazareth from Megiddo?
Well, you can stand at Megiddo, which I first did in 1988, and you look across the Jezreel Valley, and you see this white chalky ridge. It runs on a little bit of a northeast angle, and about halfway down this ridge, which probably, it's a 6-7 mile ridge. In the center of it is where the town of Nazareth was placed, overlooking that portion of the Jezreel Valley, which you're quite correct, is known as the Valley of Armageddon. Hadar in Hebrew is hill, and so we get Hadar Megiddo, Hadar Armageddon. It's the Megiddo is the root of the word Armageddon. And so, you know, when you first stand there and look across this rich valley, and you see that's the Nazareth Ridge, and that's where Nazareth was, you realize that the Prince of Peace grew up every day overlooking the Valley of Armageddon. It's quite a juxtaposition.
Now, he was baptized by John in the Jordan, so that's east of Jerusalem, down at sea level or below. Wandered the desert and then came back to Nazareth at the end of his 40 days in the desert. It's really at the very beginning of his ministry. What do we know about the desert experience? I mean, so little is said. I want to know so much more about that desert experience, I guess, that I'll never know until I can maybe ask in person. But he came out of that and was launched into his ministry. And was the first place he went Nazareth?
Well, I can tell you haven't been paying close attention to some of our prior discussions here when you called him John the Baptist.
Oh, John the... Oh, I'm sorry. Yep.
John the Immerser.
The Immerser.
Mm-hmm. Who really didn't baptize Jesus, not in the sense that, you know, the only baptism we have today is a believer's baptism, and that certainly isn't what Jesus needed. He was immersed, and there are five reasons that one immerses in that first century culture, one of which is a consecration unto ministry, and that's what John the Immerser did. He immersed Jesus. And it was his consecration in our language today. We might say ordination or consecration into ministry. So that's what he did. And perhaps, you know, the desert experience is a whole nother discussion by itself, but let's just suffice it to say that the first thing Jesus had to do before commencing his ministry was to establish his authority over his adversary. And so that's one of the profound outcomes of that 40-day experience is he triumphed over his adversary. His adversary knows that. No one else does in this land, not the disciples he's shortly to call. But it's very significant that Jesus had to go into the wilderness to be supported by his Father and to establish his dominance over his adversary as he is now ready to launch his ministry. So anyway... shall we go back to Nazareth and pick up and
Let's do that, because it was an early stop in his ministry, and you've taught us before, nothing happens there by accident. I mean, he went there for a very specific reason, to accomplish a very specific purpose. Tell us about that.
Well, in verse 18 of Luke's 4th chapter, there's our continuity here. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me. And he's already talking about that consecration experience, that immersion by John. He's making reference to that. And he makes five statements. Now, some say that this is what he actually read from the Isaiah scroll. I'm not of the school that leans in that direction, because Isaiah 61, 1 and 2 don't read this way. If you do a close word-by-word comparison, this is mostly Isaiah 61, 1 and 2, but two phrases from those first two verses have been omitted, and a phrase from Isaiah 58, 6 has been imported. And so there's a little bit of a rearrangement that takes place here that creates these five statements. So what I would suggest, and we pretty much know, that when you read from the prophetic scrolls on Shabbat, you're going to read a chapter or two. And this certainly isn't a chapter or two. But as we commented last week, after the chosen rabbi of the day, the chosen Pharisaic rabbi of the day, you can't be a rabbi and not be a Pharisee, reads from the prophetic scrolls of that particular Shabbat, he is expected to do his commentary. And this is a culture that really appreciates and looks forward to creative commentary from their rabbis. And that's why the oral tradition is always expanding in this religious Jewish world. It's because rabbis are coming up with more and more creative interpretations of God's word. And so Jesus probably read from a chapter or two, which might have encompassed all of what we know as Isaiah 60 and all of Isaiah 61. And now he's going to do his commentary. So he decides to go and do a cut and paste, I would suggest, and pulls five statements together, most of which come from Isaiah 61, 1 and 2, which is fine with these people because, as we commented before, they love Isaiah 61, particularly verses 4 through 7. And so as Jesus starts out with verses 1 and 2, their anticipation continues to build. Oh boy, we can't wait till he gets down to verses 4, 5, 6, and 7. Of course, Jesus knows this as well, and he does a cut-and-paste recitation of Isaiah 61, 1 and 2, and then abruptly stops. And let me now make a few observations here. If you are an observant Jew listening to a rabbi tell a story or recite something, you are automatically looking for the structure of what's being said. And so there's an organizational thought process here called parallelisms. Our contemporary understanding of that phrase might be called chiasm. Chi is X in the Greek alphabet, and it's a reversal of things. We use some of those today. Let me give you a contemporary chiasm. When the going gets tough, the tough get going. Mm-hmm. So if we were to write this on a blackboard, we'd put going, tough, and then down below it, we'd put tough and going. And if we drew a line between the two tough words and we drew a line between the two going words, we have an X or a
comma. Gotcha.
That's the parallelism. Now, Jesus is speaking here in an inverted form of a parallelism. So I want you to think of the letter V that we're then going to rotate 90 degrees so it looks like an arrow. And it's an open arrow. It's got two edges on it, and then they come together and make the point, okay? Mm-hmm. So we're going to try to use radio as a blackboard.
You're doing very well.
Yeah. So now you're going to organize the comments that the rabbi or the teacher makes and find the parallelism construct here. So Jesus, this is very first statement, says, I have come to proclaim good news to the poor. That's a proclamation statement. So the very first statement he makes is a proclamation statement. Then the second statement he makes here, he has sent me to proclaim release to the captives. That word captives can easily be understood linguistically as refugees. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's a social justice statement. All right. So at the edge of our V on its side here, at the top corner, we've got a P. And now halfway down towards the point, we're going to put SJ for a social justice statement. And now the third statement that Jesus says, the regaining of sight to the blind. That now puts us at the point. That's mm-hmm. the third statement. And then let me just comment on regaining of sight to the blind. You got to remember that Pharisaic theology in this first century has said, if you have a physical deformity, it's because God doesn't like you. And so, obviously, if God doesn't like you, he isn't going to heal you. So when Jesus says to regain the sight of the blind, this is just at cross purposes with their theology. Hmm. Why in the world would God be compassionate and merciful to someone he doesn't like? And so that's at the very point now. Now look at the fourth statement. Set free those who are oppressed, and that would be from social, economic, and sin oppression. There's a second social justice statement. And then he winds up with his fifth statement, proclaim the year of the Lord. There's our second proclamation statement. So we've got P1 at the top of our inverted V here. We've got P5 directly across it in a symmetrical way. We've got SJ2 halfway down the top side, and we've got SJ4 halfway down the bottom side. And in the center of it is a compassionate and merciful statement. So see, we have a symmetry here. Two P's, two SJs, and at the center of this, a compassionate, merciful statement. Now, the way the mind of the first century observant Jew has been taught is to look for the center, the point that I'm calling here on mm-hmm. this V, and it's a compassionate, merciful statement. That's the foundation, that's the core of what Jesus wants to make as his fundamental point. And so what Jesus is really saying here, this is my rescue manifesto. This is my mission statement. This is why I have come. It is to bring compassionate mercy to a proclamation of the good news, and it's to bring a compassionate and merciful social justice, and I'm going to do both at the same time. We in the Western world want to pick one or the other or give emphasis to one or the other. We pick and choose. The Hebrew mind doesn't work that way. It's all about fusion and synthesis and keeping things together. And so what Jesus has just said is, this is what I'm going to do. Watch me. I'm going to have a compassionate and merciful proclamation of the good news, and I'm going to do social justice things in a compassionate and merciful way. And this is what I expect my disciples to do, and this is what I expect my church to do. This is his rescue manifesto, which really jumps out at us once we understand this inverted parallelism construct that rabbis use when they teach, and how Jesus used it here to organize these five statements.
Now, when they heard that, it was not what they were expecting. It was different.
Not because God doesn't give compassion and mercy to people who don't deserve it.
Would they understand what Jesus had just said to apply to the Gentiles also?
Not at this moment, but mm-hmm. shortly that moment is going to arrive on the scene as we continue to progress here. But let's just put this one in place. This is Jesus's rescue manifesto. And we get to understand the heart and core of it and how he plans to live it out. And you think it's any surprise in Luke that we see one compassionate, merciful event after another initiate his ministry?
Hmm. No, it makes sense. It's cogent.
It certainly does. So far, so good, I would suggest to you. But now it's going to start to get a little dicey. Jesus has just read from a messianic passage. They all know it's a messianic passage. It strikes me that the way he read it as if he was the Messiah. I've often wondered, how did he pronounce the word me in these five statements? The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives. I'm just fascinated by how he would have handled the word me and what kind of emphasis he would have given it. My suspicion is he gave it a strong personal identification, as he is building the case here pretty quickly that I am the Messiah. And that is news that is not going to go down well with his friends and acquaintances from this little town of Nazareth. So then, having just made these five statements in this inverted parallelism, Luke writes down that Jesus closed the scroll, gave it back to the attendant, and sat down. And I think these words, sat down, here are enormously important. One of the discoveries that was made at the synagogue in Chorazin, which is about 2 miles from Capernaum, is the seat of Moses. It's a big seat, a stone seat, that's at the front of a synagogue, and it's kept empty most of the time, awaiting Moses' return. And when the rabbi of the day wants to bind those in his audience on the creative interpretation that he has just made, he will sit in the seat of Moses. Now, they don't always sit in the seat of Moses, but when they do, they're saying, what I have just interpreted for you, you must now believe for the rest of your life, because rabbis have this authority to bind and to loose. That's what rabbis do.
So sitting in the seat basically said, I have the authority to say what I just said.
And I have the authority to bind you to it. Mm. Must believe it. Mm. Okay.
Now I've got to back up just a little bit here. Did the Jews expect Moses to return himself in physical form?
Both symbolically and perhaps for some physically, there was this expectation that perhaps Moses might return someday. Because Messiah may take the form of the reemergence of Moses.
Uh-huh. You know? I had not heard that. So it was more than a symbolic thing, having this empty seat at the front of the synagogue.
For most, it would have come with an expectation. Whether that expectation would ever have been filled doesn't seem to be the real issue here. But it does point out how revered Moses was, and how the Pharisaic custom has evolved here, that if I sit in Moses' seat, people in the audience, it's as if Moses said it himself. Hmm. And see, the oral tradition all has its roots back to Moses. And so that's the connecting of the dots here that I think brings this all together. So Jesus basically declares himself to be Messiah in what he read and how he read it. And then he sits down. He's now bind his audience on what he's just said, and he's going to bind his audience on what he is now about to say. And so in verse 20, Jesus sat down, semicolon, and the eyes of all in the synagogue were fixed on him. I'll bet they were. Now that he's sat in the seat of Moses, now he's going to bind us on what he's about to say. What is that going to be? And then Jesus says, and Jesus began to say to them, verse 21, today this scripture has been fulfilled. That's a fairly weak word in English here. Let's put the word initiated, or the word commenced, or to use some slang here, kicked off, launched in your hearing. In other words, the messianic age is now here, and I am him, and you are bound by that understanding. How do you think this is going down at this moment in time?
I think of a lightning bolt hitting them.
Absolutely. He's claiming divinity. He's claiming to be Messiah. In this culture, anyone who dares do that is subject to blasphemy and death. Hmm. Well, I would say this is rage crescendo number one. There's going to be three waves of rage here that start to unfold, but this is the first wave of rage that hits them. And all of that now is important for us to understand verse 22, which I would suggest to you has long been mistranslated here in the West. But let's read it as it is in almost every one of our Bibles, and then we'll go back and make some observations and correct it. Verse 22, now all in the audience were speaking well of him, really, and wondering at the gracious words that were falling from his lips. And they were saying, is this not Joseph's son? Does that make sense based on what we've just gone through contextually here?
Not at all. In fact, I would think the fact that they knew him would have diminished the power of what he had just said. It would have made him more the heretic and more guilty of blasphemy, because they knew him. that was not what they expected for the Messiah.
Well, let's get into the Greek here a little bit. Verse 22. The Greek word is all we're speaking of him. It's up to the translator to determine how they were speaking of him. Right. So if you're a Western translator and all of this contextual stuff or even half of it is missing, you probably don't see what's been going on here from a dynamic. So I would suggest to you all we're speaking ill of him, not well of him. Okay.
Eyebrows were raised.
Absolutely. And wondering at the gracious words. Well, you know, when we read these words, how do you identify sarcasm in a word? You have to have the context.
Yeah.
So I would say all we're speaking ill of him and wondering at the gracious words. They're angry. They're ticked off. Yes, they were gracious words, but they don't like it. And saying, is this not Joseph's son? How dare he do that? He grew up in this village. He understands social reciprocity. We took care of him. He's obligated to be good to us. How dare he walk in here and say he's Messiah? So, verse 22, I think, has really been weakly handled translationally from a contextual backdrop point of view. But this now all makes sense, at least to me and others that I've studied who really dug into this, is Jesus has declared himself to be Messiah, and it's not going down well. And so I suspect at this point in time that these brand new disciples are beginning to say, we better get out of here. This is a political campaign. His handlers would be saying,
getting hot in here.
Out of Dodge here. This is not going well. And here we start to understand and see a very confrontational Jesus, a very much in your face Jesus. And so he continues on here, and he said to them, no doubt you will quote this proverb to me, physician, heal yourself. Whatever we hear was done at Capernaum, do here in your hometown as well. And Jesus said, truly I say to you, no prophet is welcome in his hometown. Now, let's just look at what these two verses have just done. This is the Middle East. This is all about mandatory social reciprocity. That means that if I do good things for you, you are mandated to do good things for me. There's a whole bunch of people in the audience who've known Jesus from his earliest days who no doubt will say, boy, we were good to you. You know, we played with you and we talked with you and we were really nice to you. And you are obligated now to be nice to us. So we want you to perform. We want you to do some of the miracles we've heard you've done at Capernaum. And obviously you have to do it because this is all about social reciprocity and we're your neighbors and acquaintances. And Jesus takes social reciprocity and tips it upside down, throws it in his ear, and he says, no way, I'm not doing it. This does not endear him to this audience. This now starts to be rage crescendo part two.
I'm trying to picture the people there. They're sitting patiently waiting for this to change. And this has got to be a shock to the whole community because they were all there, weren't they? It's a Jewish community. It was the Sabbath. They were in the synagogue. And you painted a picture for us last week of the men below and the women even behind a curtain on a second floor listening to all this. This was the internet of the day. This was the Facebook of the day. Everybody was there listening and understanding what was going on. They had the context. Their eyebrows were raised. They were getting steamed at this.
More than their eyebrows. Their blood pressure is starting to boil. There is rage being expressed on their face. The audacity of Joseph's son to come back here and say such a thing and then to refuse social reciprocity after all we've invested in him. I mean, this is just an awestruck moment. These people are probably dumbfounded for a moment and before the rage actually starts to take over, and they can hardly fathom what they've just heard. Now, the disciples, continuing on our political analogy here, if they were his handlers, would say, now we have really got to get out of here, and we have to get here fast. And not Jesus. This is not gentle Jesus, meek and mild. This is very controversial, confrontational Jesus. And he keeps going. And then he says, verse 25, "But I say to you in truth, there were many widows in Israel in the days of Elijah, when the sky was shut up for 3 years and 6 months, when a great famine came over all the land, and yet Elijah was sent to none of them," none of the Jews, "but only to Zarephath in the land of Sidon," that's Gentile land, "to a woman who was a widow." Jesus is citing an example of God's mercy and compassion to a Gentile. Oh, my goodness.
Fanning the flames, I would say.
Absolutely. And part of the issue here, he is quoting from their Old Testament. He's not making this one up. They know their Old Testament scriptures well. They know he's speaking from the Old Testament record, and they don't like it. But furthermore, Naaman was a Syrian general. Syria is the most hated of all of the countries around Israel. Their northern neighbor, Syria, is their most despised and most feared enemy. And Jesus is citing to them God's compassion to a general of the Syrian army. Oh, talk about rage crescendo 3.
Not politically correct, was it?
No, and it's confrontational. And because this is Jewish first century, in a Jewish court of law, you cannot make your point with one witness. You have to have a minimum of two. So Jesus brings out a second case history, a second witness. I actually skipped by one here, verse 25. "But I say to you in truth, there were many widows in Israel in the days of Elijah." Right, we talked about this, the Gentile woman from Sidon, all right? So the leper here, Syrian, Naaman, the Syrian general, is example number 2. So now Jesus has made his point from their Old Testament record that God is indeed merciful and compassionate to Gentiles, okay? And when I talked about compassion and mercy and being at the core of my ministry, I'm going to include Gentiles into that as well. And so at the end of this second case history, Luke, in very succinct language here, "And all the people in the synagogue were filled with rage as they heard these things."
You know, your description of the translation glitch in there explains a lot as to how I've reacted. That always mystified me, how they could turn to what made them mad. You wouldn't get that clue not having this cultural context.
No, it's like somehow an immediate switch took place where when you put it back in context, you can see 3 different reasons why their rage continues to build. It escalates. It's like a stair step, step 1, step 2, step 3, until now they're at the point where they want to kill him.
But they don't. And I presume that he knew that would be the reaction.
Absolutely. And let's finish up here in 2 more verses. Verse 29. "And they," the congregants, "got up and drove him out of the city and led him to the brow of the hill on which their city had been built in order to throw him down the cliff." Now, part of the protocol of stoning somebody for blasphemy is that they must be thrown into a hole or off a ridge that's at least twice as tall as they are. So, you know, the average person was 5'2" in this time. So it had to be at least a 10-foot drop that you had to push the person over. And then you took fairly large size rocks and you concentrated on the head first, and then you worked your way down the rest of the body. That's sort of the stoning protocol. And so according to Luke's record here, they took him out to the edge of a cliff. And I can take you in a helicopter with some of the video footage we have on our DVDs and fly you around where tradition says the Nazareth brow was. And it's about a 60-foot drop. And it's straight down. So we don't know if that's the actual place or not. It's where tradition says they took Jesus. But it's scary, believe me, when you see that clip. And in a remarkable verse, that is very short in words, but profound in the dynamic that it tries to capture. Verse 30, Luke says, "But passing through their midst, he went his way." And so in my mind, they're forcing Jesus out of the synagogue, out of town, out to the brow. There's this angry lynch mob almost that is pushing him forward and forward and forward. And there comes a moment in time when Jesus turns and faces the crowd and then starts to walk towards them, and they separate, just like perhaps the Red Sea separated when Moses escaped his people. And Jesus calmly walked through that separation and went back to Capernaum. What a verse. I mean, what a moment that must have been.
Now, I remember you teaching something about that brow of the hill being more than a mile away.
Yeah, there's a prescribed number of steps that you can only take on the Sabbath, and that traditional site would be more for a round trip, the number of steps than they were permitted to take. So that's why it's called the traditional site of the brow of Nazareth. It's a very dramatic place, but it probably wasn't the real place because it's a little too far. It's about a mile away from Nazareth itself.
Gotcha. So it happened probably closer to the synagogue than that for reasons of the Sabbath regulations, the Sabbath laws. Interesting, interesting stuff. And and so he went on his way. And from there, where do we go next week?
Well, we ought to think about that, and let me think about that. I'll get back to you on that, but I just want to make a parting observation here. After, and we now go to Luke 5, and the first disciples are called, and the very first encounter in Luke 5, 12 to 15, Jesus heals a leper. You see any connection?
Well, you talked about Nahum.
Exactly. He reprises the healing of a leper, just like God did with Naaman. And it's a hearkening back to what he just said in the Nazareth synagogue. And it's his stamp of authenticity. I am the Messiah. I'm doing the same thing that God did. I have told you my ministry is going to be a compassionate and merciful preaching of the good news and the bringing of social justice, and watch me do it. And just to really make my point in spades here, I'm going to heal a leper.
And just to hearken back to one of our earlier lessons, you'd mentioned that the priesthood, the official view of the religious establishment was there in that time and place, was that no one could heal a leper other than God himself.
That's right. Healing a leper was considered to be so difficult, it would be the equivalent of bringing back someone from the dead. Lepers were considered to be living dead, that no one will do this until Messiah comes, when he will do it. And so that's why I would also suggest that Jesus' very first act of mercy and compassion, as recorded by Luke, is the healing of the leper, because this is the Goodyear blimp flying all over this area, as well as Jerusalem, saying the Messianic age has commenced, Messiah is here. And that's why Jesus says in Luke 5, 14, and he ordered the leper to tell no one, but to go and show yourself to the priest in the temple and make an offering for your cleansing, just as Moses commanded. The reason Jesus said, don't go tell anybody what's just happened, because if he started to tell a story, he never would get to the temple. He'd be sidetracked so much. It's not that he's trying to keep quiet or under wraps. And sending that leper to the temple, where they would get inspected in the chamber of the leper, which is one of the four corners of the court of the women at the temple in Jerusalem, he immediately is sending his calling card to the establishment, to the Jerusalem aristocracy, that the Messianic age is here. And that's really emphasized because in Luke tells us that this leper was covered with leprosy. It's a terminal case. It's he's probably approaching death, or death that's in the offering here. This is an incredibly severe case of leprosy, and he has been healed from it. And there is no question that Messiah did it. The Messianic age is here, and that's why as soon as this encounter is over in Luke 5:17, listen to this. One day Jesus was teaching, and there were some Pharisees and teachers of the law sitting there who had come from every village of Galilee and Judea and from Jerusalem. healing of the leper and sending him to the temple has put Jesus on the radar screen. Everybody now is on the alert. Is Messiah here or not? Go check him out and send reports back to Jerusalem. So what I really like about context is the flow here. You know, you can't just jump in and study any passage without dealing with what's come before. The past is always the prologue for the present passage. And so the connection here between Jesus' editorial comments on Isaiah 61, 1 and 2, and then his references to the two case histories of Gentiles being healed in the Old Testament, one of which was the leper, and then Jesus healing a leper as his first official act of compassion and mercy in his ministry, all flow together, all connect. They all make sense when you get up at 5,000 feet and look down on these scenes.
Doug, this is so enriching and so powerful. I mean, they talk about bringing it into three dimensions in full color. This does the trick, and listeners are excited to get this. I want to mention, too, to folks in our area that Doug will be out here in the spring in April. He'll be at Lakewood Evangelical Free Church in Baxter, Minnesota, for a Bible Alive seminar weekend, April 5th and 6th, and you'll hear more about it as we get closer to the time. But, Doug, we'll be delighted to see you, and I'm so glad that you can find time each Wednesday morning to be with us here on Broken Road Radio, because it's a delight and a real education, and I thank you.
You're welcome. It's always fun to share these things.
Doug is the executive director of Preserving Bible Times, and there's a website. It's a wonderful resource to know. Bookmark them on your web browser. PreservingBibleTimes.org. You can link there right from where you're listening this morning, probably at BrokenRoadRadio.com. Link over on the right-hand side of the page there. And, Doug, we will look forward to next week. And we'll be in touch over the subject matter, and hopefully we can pick up right where we left off. David has a comment. David has raised his hand there.
I'm looking at the clock, and I'm saying, oh, I got to get this in. And I've got about four burning questions, but I'll nail it down to maybe just one or two. Now, you said that after this day, after this event, then he went out and found disciples?
Well, actually, no. He did an exorcism or two, and he healed Peter's mother-in-law one Sabbath. From her temporary fever, and then he calls the early disciples with Simon and the great catch of fish.
So there were some disciples at the scene at that time.
In Nazareth, you're talking about.
In Nazareth, yeah. Mm-hmm. On that particular series of days, and their response was to shrink into the crowd, you used the word handlers when you were talking about it, and in the sense of a political campaign. And I guess, what I'm thinking about is that the handlers would pull him aside back into a side room somewhere and look him square in the eye and say, pal, listen, you gotta pay attention here. The whole ball game is on the line. You can't do this. Is there any suggestion that any of that took place, or were they just kind of stunned as well as all the other people around him?
Yeah, I'm being creatively speculative when I do that, because I think it helps us to appreciate the dynamic, what's going on. Somewhere between stunned and scared is where we're going to find these disciples.
Okay. The other question, more an observation. I seem to remember that at the Bat Mitzvah that I was at earlier this year, that there was a chair up on the stage on the front near the altar. And it was this particular chair was kind of it was a more of a decorative chair. It wasn't very symbolic, but I always wondered what it was. And now it sounds like that was the Moses chair.
I can't speak to that to the extent that tradition has continued, but they certainly still do revere Moses.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much.
And we better wrap it up. Doug, again, thank you so much. We will look forward to next week. Doug Greenwald of Preserving Bible Times, and the website, again, preservingbibletimes.org.
How about we look at that leper passage next week? That would be good continuity here, don't you think?
Let's do that. Okay. Let's do that. Okay. Music from Pam Thumb on a Broken Road Radio Wednesday morning. Good morning to you.